In this episode, I am delighted to be joined by Martin Bingesser. Martin is very well known in strength and conditioning and track and field circles. He is a former world-class hammer thrower, is now a very highly respected hammer throwing coach, and works with a variety of sports in strength and conditioning. There are many parallels between developing the ability to throw far and swing fast, and the goal of this episode was to learn as much from Martin as we could. This podcast does not have any sponsors or ads. If you like the podcast and want to support Fit for Golf, check out the Fit for Golf app at www.fitforgolf.app. Now to the show. Martin, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So as we were chatting about just a little bit before we started recording, I've been listening to and reading your stuff for a long time. One of the places that I go to try and educate myself about improving physical preparation for golfers is the throwing world, because I think it's done very well there. And you're one of the resources that I kept on finding. Could you please provide the listeners with your background in the throwing and strength and conditioning world, please?
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad you enjoy the site and find it useful. I mean, that's one of the goals we've had of a lot of the content we've put out there and the stuff I've been working on online is, you know, the throwing world is small. So we want to try and create parallels where people can draw from those conclusions and apply them to other sports. But yeah, as you mentioned, like my background's in the throwing world, track and field. I've been doing that since I was 14, started in the shot put and then transitioned over to the hammer throw, was a walk-on thrower at the University of Washington, turned into a two-time All-American, and then my family's Swiss, so I competed for the Swiss national team and was 11-time national champion, probably dozen competitions I represented them, and competed at the European Championship. So my career spanned the whole spectrum. And as I was throwing, I also started coaching in parallel. I've always been a student of the sport. I was my own coach for a bit, always trying to figure out how can I do this a bit better. So that led me to start coaching, and I was actually national coach while I was still national champion. And since I've stopped throwing at a high level, or at least I still go out now and then to throw, as I'm sure a lot of ex-professional golfers still play a couple scratch rounds. But, you know, as I focus more on the coaching side, I've really gone all in there, and I've been national coach now for 10 years in the hammer throw. And also for the last 8-9 years, started to expand to do strength conditioning for other track and field events, but also other sports, including rugby and some other team sports as well.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So we have a wide range of listeners to this podcast, middle-aged or senior golfers, and also golf coaches and parents who are interested in developing juniors. So I think a nice place to start would be, it's quite a broad question and leaves it open-ended for you. But as I said, I think that track and field throwing is one of the best places to learn from for people interested in physical development for golf. So how are high-level throwers developed through the stages from junior to adolescence to competing at high-level adult events?
In general or just on the strength conditioning side?
I think both. So if you're looking at starting with juniors, where is the emphasis? What happens when they're, you know, maybe in their early development stages? And then how does that change as they progress through the ranks? And I definitely would like it to be technique and physical, because I think that's one of the things that throwing does exceptionally well, but is not done so well in golf.
Yeah, and I think I'll answer this. You sent over another question we were talking beforehand too about, you know, how come track and field seems to have a bit of leg up in this area of integrated strength conditioning? And I'll throw this answer in there as well, because I think they're related. But I think track and field does it real well. And it's not a matter of that we know more than others, but we just have a lot more experience at it. I think we've been doing strength conditioning since it really became popular. But also more importantly, when it started, the technical coach was also programming the strength conditioning. And so you had one coach doing everything. And so that crossover, that generalist approach to the coaching helped coaches see, okay, where does this fit in? Where is this helping? Where is it not helping? Rather than, I think a lot of sports that have come late to strength conditioning, it's a very segmented approach. You might have a specialist strength conditioning coach or a personal trainer or a CrossFit box or some other person delivering the S&C program. And then you have, you know, the golf coach or it could be tennis, it could be any number of sports. And that you have the knowledge there, but it's so segmented and siloed, it's hard to bring it all together. So I think, you know, back to your question about how do we develop athletes, of course, there are numerous different approaches there. You know, it's not easy to say there's one way to do it, but I think in general, especially with rowers, strength and technical development and skill development, all those tend to be developed in parallel. You don't have a lot of early beginners in the throwing events. When you say, I mean, most people probably start at high school age, 14, maybe 13 or 12. They come from a bit more generalist backgrounds because you don't see a lot of 8-year-old hammer throwers out there. So, you know, when you start out, you're throwing, you're learning the technical basis, you're learning the fundamentals of the technique. And at the same time, you're learning how to lift, you're learning how to, you know, run and jump and throw and all these things together. And, you know, you start at that younger age, and a lot of it is just gradually, as the athlete builds that base, adding more volume on top over the years, adding more intensity, adding more complexity, and all those things over the years. So I think, you know, if you look at a lot of the elite throwers, how they trained at 18 and how they trained at 28, the basic components were there the whole time. The volumes are going to be very different. The focus might be very different. You know, they're going to, over the years, have the capacity to do a lot more specific work, a lot more throwing. You know, when they're younger too, they also have an engine where they can probably just put in a lot more of that general work and recover from it a lot better. And so all that's going to change, you know, the emphasis and the volumes are going to change over the years. But I think a lot of those components remain static throughout the whole process.
As throwers have had more time to learn the basics, get comfortable with the technique and build up their training background, when they start getting to the higher levels, what causes the biggest amount of separation between throwers? What leads to some throwers getting to a much higher level than others, even with similar backgrounds and training? Is it they're able to develop a better technique? Is it more to do with physical capabilities like strength or explosive power? Or how do you see that?
I mean, obviously there's a physical component to it. You have to be able to generate a certain amount of force to be able to throw a certain distance. But, you know, that's the same way you could say in golf. And there are a lot of people out there capable of producing that force, but not a lot of people out there throwing that far. You know, you could pull some Olympic weightlifter off the street and they're able to produce immense amount of force, but you put a hammer in their hand and they're not going to throw very far. Just like I pick up a golf club, I'm not going to be able to drive very far, or you might have a huge slice and it's going the wrong direction. But that physical side, it's important. You need a baseline. There's no one at the world-class level that's weak, but that's not the separator among the top throwers. I think there are a couple sides. I mean, one is it's kind of an intangible, it's hard to put a finger on, but it's that coordination, rhythm, and ability to feel the implement and work together with it. And that's where you lose a lot of that power. You see these power leaks. It's where, okay, I have a, you know, I'm turning with the hammer and I've got a ton of power, but, you know, I'm forcing it. I'm moving ahead of it instead of moving with it. And so all that power I'm capable of generating starts leaking, and the amount that actually gets to the implement is a lot smaller. So I think that's one thing. And that comes down to the technique on the one hand, but even more than technique, I think it's just that feeling. That's what I'm saying. It's a bit hard to say and a bit intangible. And I'm sure you've seen this in golf, people who have maybe unconventional technique, but really good feeling. So it's not about necessarily the positions they hit or how they do that, but it's, are they really working together with the hammer or the club and able to transfer everything they have into the implement? So that's one thing. And the other thing I think is more and more is the mental side and the ability to maintain focus and over the years. And, you know, you might say that you overvalue this, and obviously the physical side is the big determinant, but there are so many studies done that look at the number of junior world champions, youth world champions, you know, youth Olympic finalists, you know, whatever level you want to look at, the number of youth elite athletes to become Olympic champions, become Olympic finalists is very, very small. And those people had the tools. They demonstrated that at a young age. They have that capacity in them, but a lot of them, you know, they got injured and, you know, they decided to focus on something else, or they didn't have the wherewithal to keep that focus through all the bumps in the road. And the ones who often come out on top were, you know, good juniors, but they stuck with it and they kept that focus and they kept getting better and trying to find that edge and where they could keep getting better. So I think more and more that's where I see one of the difference makers is that mindset that people bring to training.
That's excellent. So obviously the main thing we're trying to use physical training in golf for is to try and increase swing speed. It's one of the challenges with, I guess, trying to compare or learn from throwing to golf is that in throwing, the throwing distance is your result, as long as it's, you know, inside the grid essentially. Whereas in golf, swing speed is like one kind of small aspect of the game overall. So there's not as much focus put into it relative to all the other skill components. A common question from people who are working on clubhead speed, or almost like a common complaint, is that they see a lot of progress early with their swing speed when they start to work on it. For example, someone starts a strength training program, they gain some miles per hour quickly, and then it starts to really stop and it gets a lot harder. Or maybe they start working just a focused effort with some feedback from a monitor that's telling them their speed. They start doing some focus with that or combining both and they see a lot of progress, but it can halt out quite quickly. With throwers, or if we concentrate on the hammer throw, how long do people tend to improve for before they start to see, you know, a really hard plateau? For example, if you have an athlete who comes out of college and they become professional, are those people spending a lot of time where the improvements are very, very small or almost even seeming non-existent?
Again, it depends on a lot of the athletes. You have some athletes who, you know, they'll peak with 19, 20 years of age, and then you have others. I just did an interview on my podcast with Olympic silver medalist from Tokyo. You know, he was throwing personal best into his 30s, and you even see Olympic finalists around 40 sometimes. I mean, I think the general consensus is, if you look at kind of the, you know, a big sample size of statistics, most throwers reach their peak in their, you know, 27, 28, 29 range. But the amount they improve from 23 to 28 tends to be smaller. I mean, that 16 to 22, 23, so that high school, college age for an American are where the big gains are made. And then it's more a process of fine tuning after that and, you know, getting things, you know, those marginal gains or the, you know, that small 1 or 2%. You know, that being said, there are huge exceptions, but a lot of it's, you know, circumstantial. Someone who started the event late obviously is going to have a later trajectory. Someone who did it younger is going to have an earlier trajectory. If they start doing real, you know, going all in on strength training when they're 14, you know, there's not that much they're going to gain on the strength side 10 years later. Whereas someone who started later with strength training probably has, you know, an untapped side on that where they can tap into. But I would say generally that's kind of the career arc of a thrower. And because for us, it's all about the speed, you know, it is, you don't see those athletes able to hold on. As they might be able to maintain their improvements, but it's really hard to make gains, you know, past the early to mid 30s.
Yeah, especially when they've had a number of years of working on that. I guess with golfers, it can be a little bit different because you can have golfers who don't start working on strength and speed until they're 65.
Exactly.
And they're wondering, how am I able to get fast? Like, you're telling me I can get faster at 65. Whereas I see all these professional athletes that are, you know, training for a living, slowing down in their late 20s and early 30s, and they don't understand that because they've gotten to their peak, it's much harder for them to maintain versus someone who's starting with no base at 65 actually can be better at 68 or 70. It's a hard one for them to kind of conceptualize sometimes.
No, but a good example is one of the athletes I train now. He does stone throwing, which is not a track and field sport. It's like a Swiss sport where basically you pick up a big rock that's 180 pounds over your head. You run down and you throw it. you know, it's kind of a farmer sport. And the guy I trained, he grew up on a farm. He's been a farmer. He came to me. He was a finalist in the major championships in his early 30s, but he had never done a structured weight training program before. And so now he's probably 36 or seven. He's asking me, I probably can't improve my strength much anymore. I'm getting towards 40. And I told him, well, you've only been lifting for a couple of years. Of course you can keep getting stronger, in the weight room, especially. So it's all a matter of perspective. If you start really late, then, you haven't been, it's more a matter of experience than age, I think, in many ways.
Is there many track and field throwers keep competing into masters levels, or that would be called seniors in golf? So like over 40s, over 50s, over 60s, is there a competitive scene there? And if so, I'd be interested to learn how good a job some of those guys and girls can do maintaining their performance from when they were younger. Completely understand that people who get to the Olympic standard, probably aren't competing in their 60s, they've had enough. But, people who are doing it more as sort of a hobby and having that focus of I'm trying to throw the hammer far, is actually what keeps them very active, keeps them training hard, and, keeps them fit and strong. Could you give some examples of people maybe, who've had a long career and sort of how well or maybe not well they've been able to maintain over time? Because that's something that golfers are very interested in with their speed, is they're thinking, I'm 40 now, but I want to be playing golf when I'm 70. Like, am I going to lose 20 miles an hour of clubhead speed, or can I sort of, keep it to a reasonably decent standard?
I think one of the there is a thriving Masters track and field scene. It's a bit hard to look at the long term analysis because a lot of the people who do it were either late starters or a lot of the Olympic champions and those types retire and then they move on to other sporting adventures. Exactly. They're fine being, the TV commentator or these other types of things, but they're not the ones, traveling around the world competing still when they're 70. So it's hard to say, but you definitely, it's something, and I've noticed this with my own training. So I stopped throwing, I'm 40 now, turned 41 this year. I stopped competitively training 5 years ago. So when I was 36, and, I've probably lost 5 to 10%. Well, let's say that if I go out and throw and I haven't thrown for 6 months, I'm probably 15-20% off my best. But with a month or two of training, I can get back within 10%. So I think it's like, you're reactivating those pathways. If it's something you've done for a long time and you have those reps, it's easier to maintain that quality. Obviously, it's going to deteriorate over time. And one of the nice things about track and field is also, like, we throw a 16-pound hammer, so 7 kilos. Once you're 50, that becomes 6 kilos. Once you're 60, that becomes 5 kilos. So we have kind of it age graded a little bit to make it a little bit easier. Whereas the golf course is still the golf course.
They do change length, though.
You can start from an earlier tee. Yeah. So. Yeah, exactly. No, but I mean, things like that, I think, can help in that regard. But still, it's going to, they have people up to 90, 100 competing. They're throwing 20 meters, 30 meters. They're not going to be throwing 80 meters. There's no way around that, but they can still be competitive in their bracket. And year to year, there's not that much loss. You actually look at it, it's like, it's just kind of a slow burn over the years where it, it might go off a little bit. And there might even be years, from 60 to 62, maybe you lose a little bit, but maybe 62 to 63, you improve. And, you look at that athlete and it's, they retired from their job. They had a bit more time to train, or, the other year they were traveling a lot for work and they didn't get to train very much. So it's very, I think as you get towards the Masters, it's a lot more dependent. You're going to lose something, but how much you lose is a lot dependent on your life, how it's set up around you. And then also, of course, injuries. That's the big derailer, is when, if you get injured or you can't train, then that accelerates the process.
Yeah, there's a lot more to it than just age. There's all the complexities of when did you start? What's your training background? How close did your true potential did you come to before the decline started, and that kind of thing?
Yeah, back to myself too. Like I said, I've lost a bit since I stopped training, but so I stopped in 2019. I did one competition in 2020 for fun, but I'm throwing the exact same distance as 2020 now. So, I mean, I'm not throwing as far as when I was training twice a day, but, I've been able to hold that distance for if, you know, the last 4 years. I know that won't stay forever, but that's still, you can maintain quite a bit.
Yeah, something I found interesting in training, I'm nowhere near as advanced in S&C as you are by any means as a professional thrower, but I still have, you know, 10 or 12 years of pretty decent kind of strength and conditioning under my belt. And something that I find with both swing speed and strength training numbers is that maintaining is, well, I'm also only 32, so it's a little bit different, but I found that maintaining is extremely easy at this point, but gaining 5 or 10% on any lift or gaining 2 or 3% on club head speed, it's like the difference in training time and effort and volume that it would take for me to put 5 to 10% onto all of my lifts and 5% onto my club head speed versus the tiny amount of training I could do and maintain all of them is just enormously different.
And that's like, I look back and I was like, I can maintain 90, 95% with so little training, especially so little specific training. Was I doing too much back then? But that's, again, that's the difference between maintaining and gaining. There's a big gap. And, you know, a lot of these elite athletes, you know, they're training hours and hours a day. More isn't always better, but at a certain point, you do need more than just the bare minimum to be able to, if you expect to move forward.
I think that too is where it's different for professional athletes, but for the more recreational athlete, that drive to keep increasing when sort of the plateau sets in and you need to try and do maybe more and more, but definitely better and better work is also where the chance of injury versus gains start to become a question. Because if you have to keep pushing it harder to try and make very small gains, it's a case of you're really like, that's the whole thing I think of when you're maximizing performance, you're always on that cliff edge of I'm trying to get the absolute most out of my body, which means that there's a risk for you push too hard. And all of a sudden now you're dealing with, you know, various types of aches and pains and injuries that almost are not non-factors, but aren't anywhere near as likely if you're just, yeah, I'm happy to stay pretty much where I am and I'll do 20% of the training volume.
Yeah, but I think there's also different ways to approach it. Like if you're trying to get the volume, of course, you can, you know, train harder each session. But I think, especially as you age, like being able to get more consistent sessions in is a bigger thing. Like, you know, if you can, you know, do multiple short sessions a week, that's probably going to give you as much is doing one or two long intense sessions with a lot less risk involved. And so building up the sessions through smaller doses and really getting the volume that way can help mediate the risk.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. Switching gears a little bit, Martin, a term that I came across from studying throwing is special strength. It's something that you see a lot when you read throwing literature. Can you give us a little bit of information on maybe where this term originated and what it means?
No idea the historically accurate definition where it originated. I mean, the common understanding is, you know, a lot of the terminology specific strength or special strength, you know, there's a whole bunch of different names for it. A lot of it came out of the different Soviet training from the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, especially in the throwing world. They really revolutionized physical training, but also the technical approach to training for the throws during that time. And so part of that was their approach to the special strength. And my own coach for most of my career was Anatoly Bondarchuk, and he was the Soviet national coach. He moved to Canada back in 2005. I'm from Seattle, which is right across the border from where he was living. And as I said, he was Soviet national coach. He was world record holder, Olympic champion. He coached Olympic champions. And his definition of it, he would call them, basically he would divide everything you can do to train into four categories. On the one hand, you have the competitive exercise, you know, that's your sport, that's golfing. You know, it might be going to the range, it might be playing with irons or woods or, you know, swinging all the different variations. Swinging a golf club, exactly. Then you have specific developmental exercises, and that's where you have exercises that are not your sport, but they contain components of the movement. So maybe they're rotational exercises. Maybe you're throwing a med ball. Maybe you're doing some twisting exercises. Maybe, you know, you're trying to break down that movement. It could also be drills with a club or things like that, where you're trying to break down that movement. Typically, you're overloading a part of the movement. Overloading can mean heavier in the one sense, but also forget overload can also mean faster.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, trying to increase the stimulus of one part of the movement so you can get better at it. And then the next category you would call specific preparatory exercises. These are ones that are using the muscles of your sport, but in a different way, a different type of movement. So a squat, you know, a bench press, you know, these kind of typical weight room movements. You're using your legs just like you use your legs in the hammer throw, but it looks completely different. And then you have general preparatory exercises, which is basically everything else. This might be, you know, general conditioning stuff or things where you're using different energy systems, different movements, different muscles, all kinds of stuff like that. But that's kind of special strength. Specific strength is what I would call in that second category, where you're trying to really break down your sporting movement and figure out how can you focus a bit more on one aspect of it to make it better.
So in golf, go ahead.
In throws, for example, like, you know, what we'll do, a hammer throw, we have a seven kilo implement, 16 pounds. You know, we wind it around our head and then we spin four times and release it. Specific development exercises for special strength work would be, okay, well, we might take a 15 kilo kettlebell and from a standing position do a release. So we're overemphasizing that release part of it and trying to... you can also get a lot more reps that way. I might be able to take 15, 20 throws of training with the hammer, but I could do 50 releases, doing med ball throws, all kinds of med ball work, twists. You know, it might take the winding movement we start with, take a heavier implement and just focus on that 100 times. Things like that would kind of fall into that category of trying to isolate different portions of the throw and figure out how we can make them a bit better.
How would you decide? I know there's probably a lot of potential reasons, but what would be some considerations you'd put into place for deciding on the different category of exercises that make up someone's training? Would it be the level of the athlete, the time of the year, or how would you decide, let's say, for example, this person really can improve their hammer throwing a lot if we can just get them stronger in general weight room exercises like squatting, rowing, bench pressing, versus someone who, this guy's been squatting and bench pressing for 5 years. He's strong as a house. Like, is squatting and bench pressing and rowing or deadlifting or cleaning or whatever it is that where we're going to get another 0.5 meters onto the hammer throw? Like, could you go into a little bit on how you think about this? Because there's some things I'd like to bring up about golf after you've answered.
Yeah, and it's... I feel like I'm answering this all the time, but it depends a lot on the context. But like all those things you mentioned are real key factors. And in the end, what I like to try and do and what I learned from my coach and what I use with my athletes is very observational. You try, and this sounds stupid, but you try and see what works and you do a lot of trial and error and you see kind of which category of stuff really fits for that athlete. I think in general, general type of work will lead to more improvements with younger, more beginning athletes. And in general, more specific type of stuff is needed for the elite athletes. Like I said earlier, you know, when you get to that elite level, everyone's strong. They're strong enough to produce that force, but what's missing is that link of being able to get the force into the movement. So then your focus shifts towards that movement. So that's kind of a starting point we have, but there are always exceptions. You know, you look at that four category scale and my Bonnerchuk, my coach, he did a lot of research on this in track and field. And in general, the transfer, he would call it. So the ability to have one exercise and training influence your performance in a competition, the transfer is higher the more specific it is. But that's all based on populations and not individuals. So you could say, okay, yes, the better I get with the heavy hammer, the better I'm going to get with the real hammer. That's going to be a very strong correlation versus, you know, if I improve my squat by 5 kilos, that may or may not improve my performance in the competition. In general, that's correct, but each situation is going to be different. And the classic example I use is like, if I'm, you know, if I have a knee injury or something like that, what's going to help me most is rehabbing that knee. And that looks not specific at all, not special at all. Being able to do that very basic stuff is going to have the highest transfer, because that's going to be able to get me back into training and get into throw. So you really have to see kind of with each athlete, what do they need to work on that's really going to help them improve? And also, what's their background? Like you said, if they've been doing a certain type of training for a long time, doing more of that training is probably not going to do that, get them to the next level. They need some variation. And so, yeah, those are all factors to consider. And in the end, that variation component is also really important. If all you do, you know, as I said, in general, more specific stuff works, but if all you do is play golf, there's no variation and you're getting no stimulus to keep getting better. If all I do is throw a hammer, I'm going to hit a ceiling. So you need that mixture of all those components. We have that mixture of all the components year round throughout an athlete's whole career. But it's always playing around with, okay, well, maybe we focus a little bit more on maximum strength for a month or two, see if that works. Maybe we go back to more explosive strength. Maybe we go back to more throwing heavy implements. And it's a lot of trial and error to see, okay, where do you get that uptick? And at the same time, you're always getting a bit of new stimulus for the athlete. So even if it doesn't work, you're learning something, you're trying out something new, and you can tick it off a list of what might work for that athlete.
That's fantastic. I think something that is important for golf relative to throwing is that in general, especially recreational golfers never get anywhere close to the level of physical development that throwers get to. And that's where their kind of argument of, in kind of the golf S&C world, there's definitely a movement where, like, there are actually, even in the S&C world in general, I would say, if you read stuff online, especially social media, there's kind of a big movement where certain coaches or certain camps say there's no such thing as sport-specific exercises. Just use the gym to get stronger, get more powerful, and then practice your sport. And I think that's too black and white, and that there's definitely like a more nuanced approach, which you've just went through there. But for golfers who generally have a long way to go in their physical development, I think there's often an argument that they don't really need to worry too much about those more specific type exercises if they're working on their general strength and power development and they're practicing their golf swing. Because that's where I think they get the big majority of their gains. And one of the mistakes that people make is they see these specific exercises that look more like the golf swing, but they don't have what you just mentioned as a very important point, which is the overload of force or velocity. So what happens then is they're essentially drills that might be practicing a similar type movement, but they're not doing anything to actually develop them physically. And then they're wondering why there's no increase in club head speed. But on the contrary, and this will probably happen in golf over time because S&C is getting more popular, if you have someone who's been strength training and working on their swing speed for 5 years, well, then it's more likely, okay, me putting another 5 pounds on the bench press or improving my clean by 5 kilos, that might not be a huge transfer now to the competitive event. And maybe then it is a case of, I need to figure out how can I generate more force in this very, very specific aspect of the swing. And that's what you, I think, broke down lovely with your kind of Bondarchuk 4 levels of training there.
Yeah. And I think that you mentioned drills, and I think a drill is completely outside this context because we almost never use drills. We use a ton of specific strength stuff, but traditionally, what would be thought of as drills, we're not doing because it's that they're lacking that overload. Like when I learned the hammer when I was 14, I did a ton of drills, and you would just take a hammer, for example, and do 20 turns in a row just to try and hone in that footwork over and over and over. And that might have some role with beginners. I also see a lot of downsides with that because hammer, like golf, is such a rhythm event. And if you're doing something 20 times in a row, you can't have an accelerating rhythm 20 times. Mm-hmm. You end up going the same speed 20 times in a row and you have none of that specific rhythm. And that's why I feel with a lot of these drills is they don't have overload. They're just going through the motions. And it's a waste of time. Whereas if you put a little bit more thought process into it, not just is there overload, but also, you know, how does that overload impact it and what's the interplay of technique? That's another thing is a lot of people, they might understand the overload part and they might see a rotational exercise and do it way too heavy. And then it starts to be very different than hammer throw or golf. For example, golf is a very elastic movement. If you put too much overload on it, it becomes more of a strength movement and the coordination starts to change. So that would be one thing I would look out for to be careful of is, okay, you want to overload it, but not so much that you lose that specificity and you might even be developing bad habits. So one way we also like to think about it too is trying to think about, you know, trying to figure out exercises where, you know, you can use all types of fancy motor learning terms for this, but exercises where you get feedback from the exercise yourself about whether you're doing it right or not. Like if we pick up a heavy implement, like I said earlier, a kettlebell to throw far, the tendency will be if I'm a right-handed thrower, I'm rotating to the left, just like a golfer. The tendency is going to be to rip away with the left shoulder on the release to try and get that extra bit of force into it. So yeah, you're overloading it, but you're also developing a little bit of a bad habit at the same time. Well, how could we change that a little bit? One thing we'll do is instead of a kettlebell, which has a handle, we might hold a big shot put or a med ball. And if you try and rip that away, your grip's not as good. The thing's going to slip out of your hand early. So you really have to be patient with the left side and, you know, trying to figure out ways like that where you can get the overload, but also be really cognizant of what is the impact on the technique as well. Because, I mean, what's the quote from Spider-Man? It's like, with great power comes great responsibility. I think there's a lot of potential in specific strength exercises, but there's also people don't recognize there's a lot of harm that can be done and time that can be wasted. And, you know, with that being said, a lot of my athletes and a lot of athletes I recommend to is I say, look, you know, focus more on the first and the third categories. Because as you said, there's a lot of untapped potential there. Young athletes, they just need to throw. They need to develop that feeling. They need to get the reps in. And they need to develop general base, not just of strength, but of athleticism. You know, also things for golf that are important, range of motion, coordination, all these types of things. You focus on those two, you're going to get a lot of the way to where you need to go. And you don't have to worry about that middle area where things can go wrong. And then when you're at a higher level, we put a lot more emphasis in that middle point because we need a bit of a new stimulus. We need some variation. And we're trying to get every edge we can get an athlete better.
Yeah, no, really, really good points there. You've mentioned overload and underload implements a couple of times. And from what I've seen in just my reading, they're very popular in the throwing world. That's also become extremely popular in the golf world in the last couple of years. There's a company called the Stack System, have basically developed a, for want of a better word, a golf shaft that has weights you can slide on and off the end, where they can change the inertia to be the same as swinging your driver, to be heavier than swinging your driver, or to be lighter than swinging your driver. How do you use over and underload implements in throwing, and by what mechanism do you think they're helping with performance?
I was having a talk with a baseball coach recently about this too, because baseballs have become more popular, throwing heavier and lighter baseballs over the past couple of years. And he was saying to me, it's what you guys do in throwing might not necessarily apply to other sports just because of the more complexity of the skill movement involved. Like you said, we're just trying to chase that number. So I say that all with a caveat. I say, you know, I don't know how that applies to golf and how that is. In hammer throwing, we typically use it to help focus on different qualities. So like with a lighter implement, obviously we're working on the speed factor a bit more. You know, they always say, like, if I want to throw eventually 80 meters with a competition hammer, and I can't do that with a light hammer now, it's not going to get there. So you need to have that capacity in you to be able to turn faster with a lighter implement. You can also get more volume in. Like if it's a lighter implement, we can get a lot more reps in and it's less fatiguing. The heavier ones develop more of the specific strength. That being said, there's also some technical components to both. Ironically for me, I found technique for me and a lot of my own throwers is a bit easier with the heavier implements because it slows things down a little bit. And so you can be a bit more conscious and focused on certain points rather than with the light ones. It goes by so quick. It's all in a blur sometimes. With the light ones, ironically, I think that's a good implement to work on patience because you want to rush it, but you always notice, oh, those easy ones where I relaxed a little bit, it went a bit further. And I'm sure it's that way in golf too. You pick up a light club, the thing whips around, you think it goes forever, but then it's actually that one where you relaxed and maybe you were a little bit longer and looser that it really went. So we implement them there too for the technical focus they can help bring. And as I said before, variation. Like if we're always doing the same thing, you're going to reach a bit of a plateau. So we'll tend to take, you know, we have anywhere, it's at 16 pounds, so 7 kilos, our competition implement. In training, we'll throw anywhere from 5, 6, 6.5, 7, 8, 9, 10. So we've got, you know, 6, 7 different implements we could choose from, and you can even break it down to 1/4 kilo or 1/2 kilo. So you have all kinds of combinations, but we'll typically throw 2 or 3 implements for, you know, a 4 or 6 week block and then switch that up. So maybe this time we're throwing the competition implement and something heavier. Next time we'll throw a competition implement, something lighter. If we have no competitions for a while, maybe we throw a heavy and a light at the same time. But you know, each block just trying to throw something a little bit different so you get a little bit of a new stimulus in there.
So does the competition implement, which for golfers would be the driver in this case, does that tend to always stay in the training week, or would it always be in each training session, or what would be the longest you'd go without throwing the competition implement?
There are a lot of throwers who always have it in all year round. They want to have that feeling. But then you also have throwers who almost never have it in. There's also kind of a school of thought where in competition with adrenaline, you tend to go a bit faster. So they'll tend to throw a little bit lighter in training because that replicates more the rhythm in competition. You know, we're not playing tournaments or competitions year round. Typically, we'll have from like a season in the U.S. would be April to June. Internationally, it might be May until September. So you have long periods where you have no competition. So we're not afraid, most coaches, I would say, to go even months without throwing the competition hammer. And we also have a ton of records and details. So we kind of know what baselines we're looking for with different ones. So if we stray away from it, we at least know, okay, what type of shape we're in. It's not that much different of a movement where we get concerned if we're too far away from it, because we're still doing this, you know, the same technique. And yeah, there's might be a couple meters difference in how far it's going, but it's not a drastically different sport.
Volume is something you've mentioned a couple of times in terms of the different training exercises, and the different weight of the implement can allow you to get more volume. So that's suggesting to me that I'm assuming throwing the hammer, the competition implement, as far as you can, or as close to as far as you can, is a pretty stressful movement that you can't be doing, you know, hundreds of times per week. Could you give some rough idea on like how many reps of throwing a hammer per week would be, you know, somewhere considered normal for a hammer thrower? Because I'd be interested to see how that compares to golf, because for example, if we like, it's a little bit tricky in golf because the golfers are doing a variety of swings with different clubs, which are going to have different effort levels and speeds. But if we just look at long drive for a second, which is kind of a spin-off sport from golf, have you seen long drive? Do you know kind of what?
There's some throwers who've actually gone into that post-career.
So like there's long drivers who might hit 150 balls at max effort in a training session and do that every 72 hours. So like, I think that because of the nature of the implements and the movement, you can probably get away with more max effort golf swings than you can hammer throws. And that also kind of has the gears turning in my head. Maybe that's a potential reason why in golf, you don't need quite as much variation because you can get so much stimulus from the training event. Whereas in hammer throw, you can't get all the volume you need from throwing the hammer because you're just going to break down or fatigue would kick in too quickly. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
I think like fatigue and recovery play a big role. And also like we're talking about earlier with aging, like I think if you've been throwing hammer for 20 years, that's part of the reason I can go out and find my previous level pretty quickly is because I've got, you know, tens of thousands of reps behind me. Whereas beginners, they need to build that base. So that all plays a role. Recovery, though, I think, you know, if I went out and I just took max throws one after another, I would fall off a cliff pretty easily. You know, we have to walk and retrieve our hammers after each throw. And so that kind of naturally builds in a bit of a recovery phase into our training. We might throw, you know, two hammers and then, you know, it takes 2-3 minutes to go get them and come back. And so in an hour, you might have 15 or 20 throws, especially if you're training a group and you got to, you know, take turns and things like that. So that plays a role also how you distribute it through the week. Like if you do one session of 50 throws, that's going to burn you out a lot more than five sessions of 10 throws. I would say typically, you know, a lot of elite throwers are doing 100 to 120, maybe 150 throws a week, broken up over five sessions. So that's, you know, 20 to 30 throws a day or a session. In that range, I tend to prefer, and what I also did with my own training is even like 12 to 15 throws a session, but up to 10 sessions a week. Mm-hmm. So really trying, instead of taking, you know, one session of 30 throws, I do two sessions a day with less just to allow that recovery element so you can get a bit more quality. And even then, not all the sessions are all out. You might have all the throws in a session are not going to be all out. Obviously, the first ones are going to be warming up a little bit. You might take a couple of throws where you're really pressing it. A lot of the throws are that 90 to 95% range. So they're still high intensity, but they're not really maxed out throws. So I would, anywhere in that range. There are also elite throwers. You know, they'll throw twice a week. Instead, there are others that do 10 times a week. So there's a range there, but I'd say probably around, you know, the 100 to 120, maybe 150 is kind of that sweet spot for a lot of throwers. And, you know, you have some other tools there. Like I said, if you're throwing lighter implements, you can squeeze in some more volume. Part of the reason we do a lot of specific strength stuff too is that the technical precision falls off after a certain point. You know, but I can stand there and throw a med ball against a wall for half an hour and the technique's going to stay the same. So we supplement it with a lot of supplementary throws and things like that. So the overall number of repetitions, if you count everything there, can get a lot higher, but it's definitely lower on a per session basis with the hammer.
Yeah, and you're putting the different weighted implements into that total volume. They're being counted in exactly, as throws. Yeah. Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that I think is really important for golfers, is trying to get a handle on their total number of swings per week across their, basically, if it's for speed, their driver and their over and under load implements. It's definitely something that I think people struggle with, and trying to get the balance right is important. Not just for seeing progress, but what I'm seeing a lot of now, I don't know, it's probably less common in throwing because the physical preparation is better and the athletes tend to be higher trained. But injuries in golfers is becoming more common from people who are trying to ramp up their speed. I think just because people are getting a burst of enthusiasm, they go into, you know, a volume of training that they can't really cope with. And then there's wrist or elbow or back issues kind of pop up just from the sudden surge and not easing into it enough.
Especially if you're not using efficient positions, or you're, you know, ramping up the volume and putting in, you know, you see this in the hammer throw too. There's not a lot of, you know, no one tears an ACL in the hammer. No one does, you know, these, it's kind of a movement where you're gradually building the speed. So there's not a lot of, you know, issues like you would have in American football, yeah, or these other sports. But the biggest thing are these chronic issues like chronic back pain. You know, if your posture is maybe a little bit tilted and you're repeating that 200 times a week with, you know, a couple hundred pounds of force pulling against you, yeah, of course, over the years, that's going to cause issues. And if I suddenly ramp up the volume, yeah, something's going to blow. And I can see that in golf too. Like if you're, you know, if your posture is not right, it's putting pressure on the wrong areas and you just double your volume. Yeah, it's going to make more sense to slowly increase the volume, make sure the quality is there, and then make sure that physical preparation basis is there that supports all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely agree with that. And something else I think is very important for people to realize is that there's no such thing as perfect technique, but even if your technique is exceptionally good, there's no possible way to throw or swing without exposing certain body parts to lots and lots of force. It's just the nature of the movement. And that's one of the reasons why I think I see probably what I'm seeing more than anything else in golf now is golfers and tennis elbow, because there's no way to hit golf balls hard or swing over underload implements fast without those tissues being exposed to lots and lots of stress. And it's almost trying to encourage people, like, yes, we definitely want you to use good technique, but there's also a point where it doesn't matter how good your technique is. We also need to manage this volume, because there's just no way for that speed to be high without these tissues being exposed to lots and lots of stress. It's just that gradual buildup.
No, you look at javelin throw or baseball, and like I joke that, you know, if you're an elite javelin thrower, you're almost required to have at least a couple surgeries in your career. Like the forces it puts on your body, you're basically going from a full sprint to a stop in a matter of a couple of feet while you're hurling this implement, and putting all that stress through your ankle, through your knee, through your hip, through your shoulder, through your elbow. Like, you know, that you're, it's a lot to ask of the body. And same thing with, you know, pitching 100 miles per hour in baseball, and these demands a lot of these athletes are putting on their bodies. You can do it efficiently. You can do it with great technique. But that's still a lot of force. You know, it's like you can have the best airbags in the world in your car, but if you get in a car wreck, like there, it's a lot. You can't do something about that level of force at a certain point. It's going to have some ramifications. So you just got to be wary of that when you're planning, to make sure that you can understand that with your whole plan.
Great. Excellent, Martin. We've got just one more information-based question. What aspects of training, if any, have you changed your mind on the most as you've gotten more experienced?
I get, like I was talking about earlier, in like an athlete's career, probably get more gains from the general stuff as you're younger. And then as the career evolves, you can invest a lot more in that specific stuff and get those gains. Where I think my philosophy has changed over the last 5 years a bit is that at some point you need to also return to that general stuff. Like, we take for granted that, oh, you know, I used to be a really good athlete. I had, you know, multi-sport background. I had all this and that. But if you've only been doing specific stuff for 10 years, those qualities erode a bit. And so you need to, you know, at least do that minimum to maintain. You know, it doesn't have to be a lot, but you can't ignore that general stuff, even if you're at a very high level, especially in a sport where you're doing one movement over and over, that repetitious point, like you're talking about earlier, an injury. So I think that whole spectrum, you know, that you need different emphasis at different points of the career, but you need all of it all the time. It might be at one point a little bit more focus here, a little bit more focus there, but I've put a lot more effort in the last probably 5 years into that general side, and also just being creative with it. It's not just a matter of general strength is bench press and squat. Well, general strength's also, you know, coordination work and skipping and, you know, playing games and, you know, playing basketball and warm up, just getting a lot of different variety of movements, learning your body, learning how to move better, doing some gymnastic stuff, you know, all that kind of work is, you know, might be 5 or 10 minutes a day. It might be in our warm up, but that's played a much bigger role. Whereas before it was, you know, predominantly focused on more big lifts, throwing specific work,
yeah,
in that area,
which you still do.
I still do, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it's just, I noticed that just in my own career too, like, you know, after training 10, 15, 20 years, doing the same thing over and over, you know, I did one season where I just went back to the basics, and my podcast co-host, he's a high school strength conditioning coach. And I just, for 1 year, I did his program that he gives his incoming freshmen. And that season was better than the season before. And it might've just been, it was variation. I'd been doing the same thing for a long time. You need some new stimulus, but it was almost like a back to the roots and doing a lot of these things. I assumed, okay, I still had that quality because I used to be able to do it. Well, you know, maybe not. Flexibility isn't what it used to be, or the coordination isn't what it used to be. And so taking a step back and looking at those things you take for granted and still addressing those in training, and it doesn't have to be a lot of time. But that's, I think, been one area where I've looked at a lot more in the last couple of years.
Yeah, really, really good stuff. Martin, I really appreciate your time and the information. Just before we wrap up, Can you let the listeners know where they can find more of your content, please?
Up on my site, so hammermedia.com. It's spelled a bit differently. It's hmmrmedia.com. I'm sure you can put a link in the show notes, but we've got a lot of content up there, articles, a couple of podcasts. For one podcast I host with Nick Garcia, like I mentioned, he's a high school strength conditioning coach and a throwing coach. Another podcast I host with Vern Gambetta, who's worked almost every sport imaginable. He's one of the pioneers in strength conditioning and athletic development. And we've got a ton of articles, a member section with a video classroom and library, you know, tons of stuff, the whole spectrum from, you know, building up general strength to specific strength and coordination work, med ball routines and exercises, core strength, all that kind of stuff we have up on the site. So if you're interested in learning a bit more about those areas, we've got a lot of resources up on the site. And you can also, I'm really not so active on Twitter or X anymore, but Instagram is still posting stuff on there. So you can find the occasional training video for some ideas up on Instagram as well at HMMR Media.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time, Martin.
Well, thanks for having me. It's good to talk. I always love talking about different sports, and I haven't played golf much. When I was a kid, I grew up next to a public course, and they always had these summer passes where you could just go out and, you know, play, you know, at the end of the day or, you know, during the off peak hours. I loved playing it growing up, but now I might go out every 2-3 years and shank a couple balls, but it's still fun. So it's nice to talk about different sports and how training concepts apply.
It's funny. Almost any time I see a really impressive thrower online, all I'm thinking is, I want to know how fast this person can swing a golf club. We need to give them a golf club, get them trained for like 2 months and see what they can do, because you see the outputs they're putting out and you're like, yeah, there's just no way that they can't swing a club really fast. Obviously, there's more to golf than that. But yeah, even thinking about the long drive stuff, you're looking at those athletes, and like no disrespect to the long drive professionals, but I think if the long drive pros that we see now had the physical development of some of the top track and field throwers, I think there'd be scope for definite improvements, you know. It's and that's kind of what I'm trying to do to a slightly lesser extent with the recreational and professional golfers I train, is like, how can we kind of upgrade the physical capabilities here and put them on top of the skill that they already have? But the challenge is that you have a very small slice of their pie in terms of weekly energy and time that you can take up with training, because it doesn't matter if they gain an extra 1.5 miles an hour if it took 10 weeks of training time, and now they can't do all the other stuff that they need to do to compete.
Yeah, very good point.
All right, Martin, thanks a lot.